Thank you. Thank you. So my name is Maria Falzoni, and my entire life I wanted to be a performer. And both of my parents were from Sicily, and they were distraught that I wanted to be a performer. You know, it was the worst thing that I could have ever chosen to do. And whenever my dad could talk about it, he would say, I have no respect for those actors. They're all drug addicts. They're divorced. And I'm like, Dad, we have drug addicts and divorcees in our family. And he's like, yeah, but look at Robert De Niro and Al Pacino and Talia Shire. And I'm like, what are you going to name? Everybody from The Godfather? There are other actors out there. And he's like, I never wanted you to do that. But I wanted to do that. And I was afraid to go against my family. So in high school, I went to hairdressing school to make my mother happy. And then I went to college. And I mean, I was not doctor material, but I figured like a psychologist or something would make my father happy. And I wasn't happy. And there was just a point where I had to go ahead and come out to my dad and say, I want to be an actress. You know? And he said, I disown you. And I said, well, you know, Dad, I've been thinking a lot about that, and you can disown me, and I'm going to be okay with that. But I will not be okay without ever trying. Because my whole life, what I've said up until now is, oh, my father won't let me. But the truth is, I'm letting you not let me. And I don't want to be on my deathbed and say, I wish I had. And having said that to my dad, it became my mantra through my life. Like I would sit there and go, on my deathbed, will I regret this? On my deathbed, will I be proud of this? And I tried stand up and I tried acting and I didn't like acting because first of all, there's typecasting. So I was never going to get the lead in the Glass Menagerie. I was never going to be Laura in the Glass Menagerie. I was going to have to wait for someone to give me a role. I was going to have to go ahead and audition. And I'm a control freak. And one of my roommates said, why don't you try stand-up comedy? And I fell in love with stand-up comedy because I could write it, I could direct it, I could produce it. If I didn't like a club, I wouldn't go back to that club. And I did my first open mic, and I was hooked. And then I ate mushrooms, and a voice told me to move to San Francisco. And I listened to the voice because it was so like, all the blah, 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 it was like, go to San Francisco. And I said, okay, I'm going to San Francisco. And I moved to San Francisco because they had this vibrant comedy scene. And I remember going to Comedy Day in the Park. And if you don't know about Comedy Day in the Park, 20,000 people converge in Golden Gate Park on the polo fields, and they watch comedians all day long. They bring, picnic baskets. And I remember watching Robin Williams and Whoopi Goldberg. And I go, someday I'm going to be on that stage. And I was on that stage. And then I decided I was going to go ahead and do the San Francisco International Comedy Competition. And I came in third, just like Ellen DeGeneres did. And then I was the only woman to ever host the San Francisco International Comedy Competition. And when you were a comedian, there was one thing, and that was to have a sitcom. So I got an agent, and I got a manager, and I was in New York, and I was making deals, and I went to L.A., and I met people in show business, and I fucking hated it. Because it was the same thing. You had to go ahead. Nobody was authentic. No one was real. It was about what could we do with you, not what I had to say. And in the middle of that, I was invited to do the HBO Aspen Comedy Festival. And I met this woman who said, you'd be great doing what I do. And I go, what do you do? She goes, I talk to young people about safer sex. I'm like, shit, I want to do that. So I thought, oh, I'll do it just to make some money, and I fell in love with it. I found what I wanted to do. I got to walk on stage and talk to young people, because I grew up really ashamed of sex, and I got to talk to them and say to them what I wish someone had said to me about sex in a very open, honest way that was funny. And I had a ball doing it. And I thought, I want to have a baby. So I had to get married, obviously. And I did. I got married. And I remember being in England, and I was doing the 20th anniversary of the Comedy Store. And I was hanging out with the comics, and they're like, oh, come and, drink and do blow. Because, that's what, people do. I didn't. I said, I'm going to Italy to get pregnant to have my daughter. And they're like, well, Maria, that's pretty specific. And I go, well, I'm telling you, I'm going to Italy to get pregnant and have my daughter. And I came back from Italy pregnant, and 9 months later, or 10 months later, had my daughter. And I have the most amazing, incredible daughter. I had this vision of a daughter, and I knew how I wanted to parent her. And she's the most amazing, badass, incredible human being. And it's like the proudest accomplishment of my life. And in her senior year, I wasn't feeling well. So I went to the doctors, and I had to advocate for my health. I said, you know what, I just don't feel comfortable, and I had this attack, and every time I press here, it's uncomfortable. And she said, well, and I said, no, you don't understand. There is no well. I'm not leaving until we find out what's wrong. And so she pressed down, and I started to cry. And she goes, oh, I think it's your gallbladder. Let's go get an ultrasound. And I went and had an ultrasound. And from the ultrasound, the radiation technician or whatever, the radiologist said, you have a couple of spots on your liver. I think you need to go ahead and get an MRI. And then the call came from the doctor that I had most likely had liver cancer, and I had to go see an oncologist. And there's two types of liver cancer. There's outer liver cancer, right? Because I don't remember the name of it. And then there's inner liver cancer, or cancer of the bile duct. And it's a very rare form of cancer. Only 2,000 people are diagnosed every year. And your survival rate is really low. Like your chances, you have a 3% chance of surviving after 5 years. And so I went to see the oncologist. And I have to tell you, there's this life where it's like before cancer, BC, and AC, after cancer. And my whole world was shifted. And I thought, well, I didn't have a choice about cancer, but I have a choice in how I'm going to be with cancer. And if I'm going to be with an oncologist, I want an oncologist that I like, that I feel comfortable with, who has a sense of humor. And I went in to meet this oncologist, and I'm like, okay, so I have liver cancer. Just, like, what are the chances of it being the dick-sucking cancer? And he's like, the dick. I go, well, I don't like to suck dick, and I really think that, you know, I don't want that cancer where you could go ahead and die in 5 years. And he's like, do you mean cholangiocarcinoma? And I said, no, I mean the dick-sucking cancer. I don't know what the hell it's called. I don't want to know what it's called. I just don't want the dick-sucking cancer. And he will not say dick-sucking cancer. And I'm like, there's no fucking way that I can spend the next how many years of my life with this dude who's uptight. So I go and find another oncologist. And I go into his office, and I go, well, you know, and I've had the tumors removed, and I do have cholangiocarcinoma. I go, so tell me, what are we going to do about this cholangiocarcinoma? I go, you don't even want to know what I call it. He goes, no, tell me what you call it. I go, well, I call it the dick-sucking cancer. He goes, well, you know what? Some doctors do refer to it that way. And I went, you are my dude. And he hung with me, and I called him dude, and I went through my 4 months of chemo, and I came out in January, and I had clean scans, and I felt good. And then in July, I wasn't feeling that great. And something said, I think it's back. And while I was going through chemo, I really took stock of my life. And I saw how much I was loved. Like, it was an opportunity to me to go through chemo and be loved. And people flew in from all over the country to take care of me. And I got to live, in a lot of ways, my funeral and make peace with death. And I went back in August to have my scans. And he didn't want to talk to me. He had tears in his eyes. He goes, I'm sorry to say that the chemo didn't work and you have 4 tumors in your liver. And I said, well, don't cry. I had an idea that this was going to happen. I'm like, tell me, how long do I have? And he's like, you probably have, like, you know, worst case scenario, 4 to 6 months. And I'm like, dude, are you kidding me? I just inherited all this money. I was going to get my tits done and my veins done. I just put, like, I was going to go ahead and buy a house in the high desert of California on Monday. And he said, Maria, I'm really sorry. I'm not a financial planner, but I would suggest that you not buy the house. And I said, okay. And I went to my home, to my daughter, and we cried. And I thought, well, all right, 4 to 6 months, what am I going to do? How am I going to go ahead and live my life? And so I thought, you know what? I want to be there for my wake. Like, I want to hear what people have to say to me. And a friend of mine said, you should have a wake. And I said, no, I'm going to have a wide awake. And like Polly, like I visualized myself, and my daughter and I joked about like I'd be laying on a table, and people could come up and talk to me, and I could hear. And then I thought, I'm too ADHD, I can't lay on a table. So I would just stand there, and people, like a reception line, because I didn't have that. And people could come up and tell me how much they loved me, and I could say, I love you. And then I could hear their eulogies and kind of like stoop. I could time them if they went too long and ring. But I was going to say, get the fuck off the stage. No, I'm going to be gentle with it. So before, you know, we were talking about that, and then I posted on Facebook to my friends, I want you to, and I, you know, disclosed that I had 4 to 6 months of life and that I loved my life and I wasn't going to do chemo and I had no regrets and that I loved everyone. And then over 600 people responded and they told me how much they loved me and what I meant to them. And I have to tell you, it was overwhelming that I couldn't, like I could read a couple and then I would cry. And I thought, you know, this idea of a wide awake isn't going to be fun. You know what I mean? Like, it's not going to be fun. Even if I have booze and, you know, disco lights, it's not going to be fun. And so I thought, I've got to get to the business of planning my death. And I met with an attorney and had my will. And I also did my... the thing when you go to the doctor and they, you know, don't resuscitate me, keep me alive long enough. If something happens here, my kid's in California, keep me alive long enough for her to say goodbye. I don't want any water. I don't want any, you know, food. Just give me lots of drugs and keep me comfortable, you know. And I went ahead and did that. And I thought, where do I want to, spend the last part of my life? And my oncologist said, you may want to think about California because it's a right to life state. And so I rented a house in California in the high desert because it's the most peaceful place. And I rented a house actually for a week in Virginia, and I called it Beaches and Bitches and had all my friends come and visit me. And I have a death box, and in it I've paid for my burial because I want to be buried with my mother, because we're Italian and you have to see a body, especially if you're Sicilian, because then you don't even believe the person's dead. Show me the frickin' body. So, and I want a place where my family can come visit me and people can come visit me. And, you know, please, you know, I know I'm a safer sex lecturer, but I don't want condoms left on my grave or... people having intercourse on my grave. I mean, I would be cool with that, but my mother would not be. So, you know, just for my mother, don't do that on my grave. And it's interesting when you tell your friends you're going to die, because now everybody wants to be there when I die. And it, like, you can't say no. You can't be there. You know what I mean? It's like planning a wedding. It's like, oh, shit, I got to get a bigger room to die in now, because... And I have to tell you that I'm scared. I'm really scared. And I'm really sad. Because I'm going to make a lot of people sad. They're going to miss me. And I have an 18-year-old daughter. And I'm going to miss her. And she's going to have a fucking hard time. For, you know, I know how I was when I lost my mother. I mourned for 5 years to get my shit together. And she's only 19. And she really hasn't had that long to hate me. You know what I mean? But I know, and I hope that it happens the way that I want, that I go ahead and lay down with all my friends with me, and my daughter gets into bed with me, and I go to sleep with my daughter in my arms. And that's it. That's it. I hope it comes true. So thank you. Thank you for letting me share my story.